Hey everybody, it's Dr. Ray Heinisch. I'd like to welcome you to the Cut the Fat Podcast. I'm thrilled to say that we've got a great podcast planned for you today. I have none other than the great Jonathan Baylor with us from the Smarter Science of Slim. Hey, Jonathan, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing real well, thanks.
Great. Tell us a little bit about the Smarter Science of Slim, and then we'll get into just shooting the breeze about fat loss, fitness, and food.
Yeah, well, the Smarter Science of Slim is the name of a book and a brand which encapsulates really the distillation of the single largest scientific analysis of fat loss and health ever conducted. So over the past decade, I've waded through over 10,000 pages and 1,100 studies worth of little-known scholarly journal articles and boring research studies and took that and made it simple, made it applicable, and made it accessible into a lifestyle where, ironically, we actually find that we need to focus on the quality of what we eat and how we exercise rather than the quantity. And in doing so, surprisingly, we eat more and we exercise less, but we do that smarter. And then we create a hormonal environment in our body that makes it act more like the body of a naturally thin person and thereby enable ourselves to achieve a long-term fat loss and health versus this yo-yo weight cycling that happens when we fiddle with the quantity of calories and the quantity of exercise that we do.
Right. You know, and we spent a lot of time, actually the whole podcast the last time, talking about this whole calorie model, the calories in versus calories out model of weight loss. And I think you did a great job of exterminating that myth for us. Thank you very much.
And my pleasure.
Today, I just want to kind of continue along that path and kind of work our way towards some of the more practical suggestions to people, like how they actually apply this and use this in their life. Last time, I wanted to ask you, but I didn't get to ask you, about this model that you talk about in the book that you call the clogged sink model. Can you kind of give us that example? Because I think it's such a terrific way to visualize this process of fat loss. Like, what's the right approach to burning fat? So give us that model.
The model, I appreciate you giving me the opportunity to talk about it because I do think it's key. I mean, one of the reasons we focus so much on calories in, calories out is we have this model in our brain, which makes sense. Unfortunately, it's wrong scientifically, but it makes sense intuitively, and that's of a balance, right? You balance calories in, calories out, and it's because that's such a simple model that it's gained so much traction. So my hope is to provide a equally simple model, but one that is scientifically sound. So that model, the alternative to the balance model, is the clogged sink model. So instead of thinking of your body like a balance scale where, you know, you add calories that tips it in one direction and you gain weight, and you take away calories that tips it in another direction and you lose weight, instead think of your body like a sink. So imagine we have a properly functioning sink and we pour more water in. Well, if we pour more water in, that just means more water out. The water level may rise temporarily, but the sink, assuming it's functioning properly, will automatically get rid of that water, right? More water in means more water out, assuming the sink is functioning properly. The only time the water level will stay elevated over the long term is if the sink becomes clogged. And now we have to ask ourselves, well, what causes a sink to become clogged? Well, we all know the answer to that. It's stuff other than water. It's stuff other than what the sink is designed to handle. Maybe hair, paper towel, you know, some tissues. That will clog the sink. And once the sink is clogged, any quantity of water in will cause the water level to rise and to stay risen. Not necessarily because too much water is going into the sink. In fact, the water just may be dripping out of the faucet. But because the sink has lost its natural ability to keep itself in balance, that water level will become elevated and the sink will balance itself out, but it will balance itself out at a higher point. And now the question is, we could, quote unquote, eat less. In the sink analogy, that would just be turning the water down. But But why? I mean, that's not actually solving the problem. That's not clearing the clog. That's not going to make the water level fall, at least not long term. And it's a pain because now we can't use our sink. Similarly, we could exercise more. And the analogy for the sink is we could take a teaspoon and like flick water out of the sink. But again, that's so complicated and unnecessary. The answer is unclog the sink. Restore the sink's natural ability to keep itself in balance at a lower point. And the way we do that is through a different quality of inputs. So maybe we put some Drano in the sink, or maybe we use a plunger and apply some force to force that clog out of the sink. And then once we've done that, again, the water level may rise temporarily, but if the sink is functioning properly and we continue to fill the sink with only things that it's designed to handle, it will never have a chronically elevated water level. Again, no quantity of water will ever clog a sink. More water in just means more water out. The problem arises when it loses that ability to naturally balance when we put the wrong quality of stuff in it. And the same thing applies to our body. No quantity of the right quality of food will cause chronic obesity. We may gain 2 pounds, but then we'll just burn it off. It's when we put the wrong quality of food in our body and we create a hormonal clog that we begin to have this chronically elevated level of body fat. And again, we are balanced out. This is why we don't gain weight until we weigh 1,000 pounds. We all level out at some point, but just like that sink, it's we've leveled out at a higher point. Our body is balancing us out just at a higher point. We need to clear that clog, get that point back down.
That's where you go on to talk about set point theory. Okay, so can you give us a little bit of an explanation as to how this works from a biochemical perspective? What's going on in the body that causes the body to level out at a particular set point?
So the body is always trying to maintain homeostasis. This is how every system in the body works. If you think about, for example, sodium or potassium, like we don't have to monitor sodium in and sodium out. The body does that for us. We don't have to monitor potassium in, potassium out. We don't have to monitor breaths in, breaths out. The body is designed to keep itself in balance. And the set point is really it's a abstraction of our hormones and our genetics, in the sense that each one of us, based on our genetics and our hormonal balance, has a level of body fat that our body seeks to maintain. And this doesn't mean there's like a little, you know, man in our brain that is controlling our system. But it does mean, however, and we've all experienced this, that, you know, we get the flu and we lose 10 pounds and then we really don't change anything about our diet and our exercise. And somehow we miraculously gain exactly 10 pounds back. I mean, the human body has been shown consistently to maintain its weight very, very accurately, even in the face. And this is actually kind of a funny thing, right? People say, you know, well, we're just eating more. That's true. We are consuming more calories than we used to. If you look back in the 1970s and you look at data, we're consuming about 570 calories more person per day now than we were back then. However, if we do some calorie math, we can see how important and how real the set point is. For example, let's assume that 570 calorie increase was gradual over about 30 years. So let's assume it was 300 calories more per person per day. So let's do some math. We've got 30 years, we've got 300 calories per person per day. So 30 years times 300 calories per day times 365 days in a year. And then we divide that by 3,500 calories in a pound of fat. And according to calorie math, we should have all gained about 907 pounds of fat. Mm-hmm. But we didn't. And in fact, if you just continue that trend out into the future, what does that mean? By 2030, we're all going to weigh 2,000 pounds? Of course not. That's because the body is actually trying. Like, it's trying its hardest to keep us at our set point. But it can only do so much when we chronically clog it with the wrong quality of food. So the set point just shows that our body tries to keep our weight and our energy balance in homeostasis, just like every other aspect of our biology. The most simple explanation is, what other area of our physiology do we need to consciously regulate? There is none. Like, our body does that stuff for us so that we can think about other things like reading and language and higher order brain functions. It's just that we've been brainwashed into thinking that we need to manually balance calories in, calories out, because frankly, there's a heck of a lot of money in selling products that make that impossible task a little bit easier.
But all those products make it so difficult. You know, a lot of people might listen to what you're saying and say, you know what, I understand what you're saying. I grasp it consciously. I grasp it intellectually. But all those things that you say that all these companies make, it seems to have like a, I don't know, it's like got us leashed up in a way to consume those types of high calorie, high fat, high carb type foods. How do we break that?
Well, I think, Ray, a lot of it is we have to start with our mind, because let's use smoking as an example. So less than 100 years ago, it was common knowledge, and scientists, quote unquote, and big businesses were legally able to tell us that smoking was good for us. It wasn't that long ago. And let's just hypothetically imagine that that never changed, that we continue to live in a culture where smoking was thought of as harmless. And we continued, and then at the same time, we started to see that rates of lung cancer were just rising precipitously. And we're like, what the hell is going on? Everyone's getting lung cancer. And then we started doing things like making candles illegal, because we thought maybe when you blow out candles, that smoke causes lung cancer. And we outlawed driving because we thought the exhaust might be causing. And it was really complicated and convoluted. And we're just like, what the hell is going on? No one had lung cancer before. And now we're doing all this stuff to try to avoid lung cancer, but we're all still getting lung cancer. Well, that's because we're smoking, and we believe that smoking is healthy. We don't need to do all this complicated stuff. We just need to stop smoking. Now, let's bring that back to food. 50 years ago, nobody in the main population knew what a calorie was, let alone counted them. And 90% of us avoided obesity, and greater than 99% of us avoided diabetes. We have been led to believe that we have to consume a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet, and that we have to do chronic and excessive cardiovascular exercise. That's a bit like telling someone, like, smoking is okay. Like, it's just false. And when you do those kinds of things, you essentially break your body. And to try to continue to live with a broken body and while continuing to ingest those types of foods is complicated and hard, just like trying to not get lung cancer when you keep smoking is complicated and hard. But if you just stop smoking, it's not that complicated. And if you just stop eating these toxic foods, which do to your metabolism what smoking does to your lungs, it is surprisingly simple, and it has to be, Ray, because nobody had this problem up until 50 years ago, right? So it can't be that complicated.
How would you define toxic food?
I would define toxic food as food that has been clinically proven to cause a detrimental hormonal impact, to have a detrimental hormonal effect in the body, while simultaneously not providing anything uniquely nutritional to us. That means nothing. They provide nothing to us that we couldn't get from hormonally helpful foods.
I have to think about that. That's a really good way of defining that.
Well, thank you.
Well, okay. So one thing that a lot of people have difficulty kind of grasping is they say, well, you know, how is it that I can eat 500 calories a day and not burn fat? Explain how that is even physically possible, Jonathan.
Sure. Well, the key thing to keep in mind, and I think I mentioned this in our first podcast, is it's not that calories absolutely count. Like, sometimes people hear me talk and they're like, Jonathan thinks calories don't count. I absolutely think calories count. What I just don't think we need to count calories. Calories do count. We just don't need to count them, if that makes sense. So back to your question. If we eat 500 calories per day, so we've decreased calories in, calories out will be decreased automatically by our body. Remember, our body wants to maintain homeostasis. Remember, we evolved in an environment where we had to work really hard not to starve. Only for the past post-World War II has food been abundant. So if you think about it in terms of, like, imagine food wasn't abundant. Imagine it was questionable where you'd get your next meal. You would be very thankful that if one day you could only eat 500 calories, your body automatically slowed down so that you wouldn't eat away at your muscles because you would already be so lean. The only thing left to eat away at is your muscles, and that's clearly bad for your health. So your body doesn't want to eat itself. It's designed not to do that. So when you eat fewer calories, your body just slows down to counterbalance that. Again, it's trying to maintain that level of that point of homeostasis. So you eat less calories, your body just burns fewer calories. And at that point, if you still have a caloric shortage, you will then burn off muscle tissue because, again, if your body is in a state of caloric shortage, what does it want less of? It wants less of tissue that burns a lot of calories. What tissue is metabolically active? Well, your heart and your brain and your liver are very metabolically active, but we can't burn that off. So next on the list is our muscle tissue, and that is what we burn off. Studies show that up to 70% of the non-water weight we lose when we starve ourselves is coming from muscle. So first we slow down, then we burn muscle, then and only then will we burn fat. But frankly, Ray, once we've slowed down our metabolism and once we've burnt off our muscle, we're now in a position where if we ever stop eating 500 calories per day, oh my gosh, we are going to gain more fat than we ever had before because we've got less muscle and we've got a slower metabolism.
This would be a good kind of transition point into this concept that you talk about in the book called which is called fat superaccumulation. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah, well, by way of analogy, let's imagine that our body is let's just tell a quick story here. So imagine you're the mayor of a city, and this city has a horrible snowstorm. And we go out and we get some salt trucks and we salt the roads, and we don't have enough salt trucks. So the city has to shut down, and it's this big mess, and we're just like, okay, finally we get the snow off the road, and we say, okay, well, you know what, dang it, we've got to be ready if this happens again. So I'm going to buy even more salt trucks to avoid this from happening in the future. I'm going to accumulate a bunch of super salt trucks. Well, the body is no different. When we're starving, the body sees this as a crisis. It has a shortage of stored energy. It's like, oh my God, I need stored energy. What's going on? Like, we're going to die. This is a life or death situation, right? If we don't have enough stored energy, we will die. There's no more greater stress that we can put on our body than starvation. So our body is like, okay, if I can get through this snowstorm, aka starvation, the first thing I'm going to do when I get through this is I'm going to buy more salt trucks. I'm going to take and I'm going to load up on stored body fat so that if this happens again, I won't die. And I'm not trying to like make this sound like some crazy thing. It is a life or death situation. Starvation is deadly. We've sort of lost sight of that in our culture, but up until 50 years ago, starvation was a bad thing, not something that we deliberately tried to do. So fat superaccumulation is just the body's natural response to starvation, saying, as soon as I'm not starving, every last ounce of energy I have is going to go towards storing extra fat. The technical term is fat superaccumulation, so that we don't die if we starve again in the future.
You know, I went to undergrad at a school called Frostburg State University up in Maryland, in the mountains of Maryland, and we didn't have much to do up there. So I would watch TV, basically, when I was in undergrad. And up in Frostburg, not much came on TV, so I would watch the Discovery Channel. And I would be fascinated by these animals that evolved to survive in harsh environments. For example, there's this hermit crab I remember seeing that would literally pick shells up off the ground. It was this little tiny hermit crab, lived on the bottom of the ocean, would pick these shells up off the ground, lick them, and then the saliva would have some sort of sticky material, would stick them to the top of its shell. And it would just keep picking up these little shells, lick them, put them on the top of the shell, until the whole shell was covered up in these tiny little shells, and then it would just lay down and it would look like sand. You know, I also saw another one with this octopus called a coconut octopus that would go to shallow parts of the water where coconuts would fall in the water. It would pick up half of a coconut shell and it would put it on top of its head. And then it would walk along the ocean floor with this coconut shell on top of its head. And finally, just as a last example, I just find him fascinating. That's why I'm telling you. But there was this this bat called the chicken bat. And the chicken bat was this little tiny little bat that would crawl upside down underneath sleeping chickens. It would then crunch up, you know, kind of sit up and lick the chicken's foot until the foot was soft enough that the that he could just take a little bite in the foot and just open its mouth and let the blood drip into its mouth. Fascinating stuff. These are creatures that were that designed or developed or evolved ways to survive their particular harsh environment. For us as humans, our harsh environment was starvation. We weren't as worried about saber-toothed tigers and lions and bears and stuff like that. We were smarter than them. We knew how to get around being attacked by those creatures. Our biggest stressor, as you mentioned, was starvation. So we evolved not to lick shells and put them on our head, but to store fat, right? And so that's why what people have to gather is that when our body is not doesn't just adapt, it learns. So it learns to be better at keeping us safe, and it learns in real time. So when we starve ourselves, that's exactly what happens. Our body learns to store fat, so you store it quickly, and then you store more on top of that. There isn't a dieter in this world, Jonathan, who would tell you otherwise. Right? Am I right?
Absolutely. Well, and the good news also, Ray, I mean, this could start to sound like a bit of a dour picture, although I'm still trying to, like, I'm salivating now thinking of coconut octopus. Like, that just sounds delicious. No, I'm just kidding. The chicken bat doesn't sound as good, but the coconut octopus just sounds delicious. Is from an evolutionary and a design perspective, right, we also evolved not to be morbidly obese. Certainly, a morbidly obese individual is at a disadvantage when on the African savanna, where there are certainly wild animals who may want to get the person who cannot run away as quickly as everyone else in the tribe. So we certainly didn't evolve to store this abundance of energy as well. And the other thing to keep in mind is, as we talk about this body automatically trying to balance itself out and seeking homeostasis, this can start to seem like, this is hopeless. Like, I have this set point. What am I supposed to do? But what's so encouraging is this set point, while part of it is fixed, like just like our genetics, like sometimes there's people that are born fast and there's people that are not as fast. Everyone can make themselves faster, but not everyone can become an Olympic sprinter. We all have a genetic predisposition to a certain body composition, but there's another aspect of that. That's our hormonal balance. And we all know this, right? As we get older, our hormones change. We tend to gain weight, and it's not because we're getting lazier, and it's not because we're getting hungrier as we get older. In fact, appetite generally decreases as you age. It's because our hormonal balance is changing. However, we can use food and exercise to change that hormonal balance, thereby changing or lowering our set point. Now, all of those things in our body that currently work to keep us overweight will work to keep us at a slimmer body composition. And if that sounds too good to be true, we all know people that do it naturally. They're called naturally thin people, right? So they eat whatever they want. They don't really exercise, and they seemingly stay slim. This is what most of us did maybe in our adolescent years because we had a unique hormonal balance. So the question is, how do we drop that point? It's not, this is hopeless. Oh my God, we have a set point. It's how do we change that hormonal balance so that we can get our body to fight, quote unquote, to keep us thin, much like it may already be fighting to keep us fat.
All right. So let's talk practical then, because you know, let's say that we have succeeded in convincing people that the calories in, calories out model is seriously flawed, and that the way to do it is to eat good foods. How do we do it? Give me the step by step. You have somebody who comes to you. We could use the example of I know that you have been coaching a couple of the Biggest Losers, right?
Absolutely.
And let's say that the first day they walked into your office and said, you know what, we went through this whole process. We lost a lot of weight. We're having difficulty. It's creeping back onto our bodies. What do we do? What do we do? What do you say to them?
Step one, I would tell them a story. I like to, you know, I think weight and health is a very emotional issue for a lot of us. And I know I like to geek out. I know you like to geek out, but I'm working to appeal more to the emotional side of them. I'm getting in touch with my emotional side, right? So the first thing I would do is I'd tell a quick story, and it's very quick. And it's Mother Teresa, who is obviously a wonderful individual, was once asked, would you march against the war in Vietnam? And she said, I will never march against the war in Vietnam. However, if you have a march for peace, I will be there. And what she was saying is she prefers to pursue the positive rather than attack the negative. If you want to make someone want to do something, tell them they can't do it. That's psychology 101. So the first thing I said when I started working with Biggest Loser alumni is I want you to pursue the positive. I want you to eat so many non-starchy vegetables, so much nutrient-dense protein, and so much whole food natural fat that you can't even imagine eating dessert. Like, just try. I want you to try for 2 weeks to always be too full for dessert. And if you can do that, one, you're going to have this – first, you're going to start to remedy your relationship with food, and you're going to start realizing that food is wonderful for you. It's nature's most powerful medication, and you don't need insurance, and it will heal you from the inside out. That abundance of nutrition will immediately give you energy. It'll make your hair glow. It'll make your skin glow. Your eyes will shine brighter. You'll feel better. You'll sleep better, and you will never – be hungry, and you will start to see body composition changes happening. And when you see that happen while feeling great, well, when you're used to seeing is nothing really happen while feeling terrible, you will start to see that glimmer of light, that glimmer of hope. And again, it's all about this positivity. It's about healing the body first through good nutrition and pursuing the positive. And when you do that, and when you have a nobler motive, like, it's not for some superficial, I just want to like lose weight. It's I want to heal and honor my body through proper nutrition. It is so much easier to stick to. And if you need any evidence, I can point to about 2 billion people. The example I like to do are vegetarians, anyone who restricts their diet for religious reasons, and any pregnant woman. All of these people effortlessly, in quotations, avoid all sorts of foods. Why? Because they believe in something bigger. They have a nobler motive. It's not just because they don't have some superficial want. It's they believe they're doing the right thing for another reason. So that's what I would start with, is that mental reboot.
What's next?
The next thing is really starting to get into the more of just the practical aspects of like, okay, I believe this, I get this, I want to do it, I have that noble motive. So what am I actually eating? Like, what am I doing? Well, I say there's three steps, and there's the two, I call it sane eating. There's two non-negotiable parts of sane eating. And of course, it's not about perfection, but you can't say you're sane unless you do these two things. They're the two unnegotiable or non-negotiable parts. And that first thing is double-digit servings of non-starchy vegetables per day. So a minimum of 10 servings of non-starchy vegetables per day. And for a lot of people, they're just like, oh my God, that's like the average American eats about one. So that's the average American. I mean, people who listen to your show, Ray, aren't average by any means, but it's a big increase. So we start to talk about how to make that practical, which I'm happy to do now if you think that'd be helpful.
Yeah, you know, I know we talked about this in the first interview, what those things were, but give them to us again. What are the two non-negotiable items?
So two non-negotiable items, again, it's that 10-plus servings of non-starchy vegetables, and we can talk about how to make that practical because it actually can be quite practical. The second is consuming between 100 and 200 grams of protein per day. So 100 is inactive small woman, 200 is large active man. For most people, you know, you're going to be in that range somewhere, but that's the cornerstones. The two bookends of your eating are 10-plus servings of non-starchy vegetables and somewhere in the vicinity of 150 grams of protein per day. And now most people are like, okay, well, how do I actually do that? So the way you actually do that – so first, you got to understand what non-starchy vegetables are. And generally speaking, they're things that you put in salads. So we're talking deep green leafy vegetables, kale, broccoli, any kind of green, romaine lettuce, spinach, things like that, mushrooms, peppers, cucumbers, tomatoes, carrots. basically anything other than stuff that's starchy. So not potatoes, not corn, not things like that. So 10 servings, oh my God, that's a lot. The other thing to keep in mind is when you cook these vegetables, they shrink down. It is incredibly easy to consume 3 servings of non-starchy vegetables, like with each meal. And if you start making green smoothies, which is something that's becoming more and more popular, so you take, you know, some spinach and some strawberries and you put them in the blender, you can really easily take in 3 or 4 servings of non-starchy vegetables while you're driving. Like it can actually be quite simple. And then when we talk about the protein, this really isn't too hard for most people because protein is delicious. We're talking seafood. We're talking good high-quality cuts of meat. We're talking things like Greek yogurt and cottage cheese. And if you just make sure you're taking in as much protein as you need to feel full at least breakfast, lunch, and dinner, at least – you will probably already be at 100 grams of protein. You then might need to do some other things to make sure you're getting into the 150 gram range. But then at that point, you're just filling in any gaps with whole food natural fat. So you're using nuts and seeds, cocoa, coconut, these delicious, satisfying fats to just fill any remaining cracks and crevices in your belly. So those are the 3 steps. And eating fat is generally really easy for most people. But the point is the fats we want you to focus on. And that's, again, natural whole food fats. So nuts and seeds primarily.
You know, I just had a patient in today whose cardiologist basically told him that I was wrong and he was right, and that was that he had to, in order to lower his cholesterol, he had to cut back on the fat. So what about this issue with cholesterol? A lot of our listeners may be thinking, well, what about my cholesterol? What about cholesterol in the protein that I'm eating? And what about fat in the diet? Isn't that going to cause problems with my cholesterol? What do you say to that?
Sadly, this concept that eating fat will kill you is kind of analogous to the myth that smoking will not harm you. Like that we talked about earlier, it is such a detrimental concept. So let's just blow this out of the water here. And there's no shortage of research to back this up. Plenty of it's documented in the Smarter Science of Slim. So the cholesterol in your diet has very little bearing on your blood cholesterol levels. Again, this has to do with the homeostasis thing we talked about. If you eat less cholesterol, your body will produce more cholesterol. To be clear, if you have no cholesterol, you die. Cholesterol is required for your body to function properly. So if you eat less cholesterol, your body produces more. If you eat more cholesterol, your body produces less. In addition to that, so that's sort of fact number one. Cholesterol, homeostasis, body takes care of it by itself. Point number two, the total level of cholesterol in your body is completely irrelevant to your health. It's sort of like saying correlating the total amount of cholesterol with health is like saying eye color correlates with intelligence. Like it's just been completely proven false. What matters, like if you want to look at numbers, what is actually showing to be the most promising thing to look at with your physician is your ratio of triglycerides to HDL. You generally divide your triglyceride level by your HDL level, and you're looking for something ideally in the vicinity of 1 to 1.5, because that's other than that, it's really irrelevant, right? Because if I say my cholesterol level is 200, well, 200 what? Is that HDL, LDL? It doesn't matter. What's your LDL particle size? It's just such a crude and such an archaic measure. If your physician, and again, physicians are very busy people, but if your physician is saying, well, based on your total cholesterol numbers, you need to go on a statin, that would be a little bit like you going to see your physician and your physician saying, well, you have the flu, so I'm going to bring this bucket over here and I'm going to bleed you, because if we can get the blood, the sick blood out of your body, you won't be sick anymore. And like that's what they did, right? Hundreds of years ago, they bled people thinking that if we get the toxic blood out of your body, you'll be healthy. And we now know that's wrong. Science has proven that wrong. Science has proven that total cholesterol levels have very little, if any, impact on health. That doesn't mean cholesterol is irrelevant. It just means we need to look at different things. We need to look at HDL specifically, and ironically, low HDL is what's very bad. So we actually want to increase HDL, because by increasing HDL, that really helps to clear these plaques, which end up causing cardiovascular disease and heart issues. And ironically, Ray, the way we do that is by doing all that we can to consume these healthful fats. So the fats found in seafood, the fats found in nuts, and the fats found in seeds. Of course, our body will fundamentally regulate this, but we can push it in the right direction by eating these healthy, whole food, natural fats, but not trans fats, not unnatural fats. I'm talking about natural fats, the things we ate for the past hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah, I totally agree with that stance. You know, one thing that I'm commonly trying to push in people's heads is the issues with cholesterol. You know, cholesterol to me is a relevant number, and it's only relevant not because it causes heart disease. God did not place cholesterol in our blood to cause heart disease. It's there for very important reasons. It produces a lot of the hormones that are produced in our body, produces vitamin D. It's important in memory, brain function, eye health. Practically, as you mentioned, you know, I've literally had cardiologists tell patients, if I could get your cholesterol down to zero, I would. And I just can't understand that. Like, do they honestly believe that cholesterol is just in the blood to cause disease? It's of course not. And in fact, the reason the body's producing cholesterol or lipoproteins more specifically, which are what we label as cholesterol in kind of the lay press, is because you have too many carbohydrates entering into the blood, too much sugar. And what the body tries to do is it tries to convert it into fat. And then what carries fat to the fat cells are these lipoproteins that we call cholesterol. So if you have a high cholesterol and you normally don't have a high cholesterol, then let's say when you were 20 and you were healthy, that your cholesterol was normal, let's say 200, what's labeled as normal. But now that you're 40, it's now 280. Well, that's significant to me, but it's not significant because that 280 cholesterol is causing heart disease. It's significant because the lifestyles that are causing that cholesterol to be 280 is what's unhealthy to the cardiovascular system. So watch your cholesterol numbers. Look at the HDL. Look at the particle size. There's a test that your doctor can order that's called the VAP test, V-A-P, Victor Apple Paul, VAP test. It tells us much more about the cholesterol than just the number. It tells us if you produce small, dense particles of cholesterol, which are more likely to end up in the arteries, or big, fluffy particles, which won't cause a problem. So ask your doctor next time to order the VAP test rather than just a standard cholesterol panel. All right? There's a little tip for you guys.
Well, and Ray, the other thing I like to keep in mind too is, again, I think I appreciate so much a lot of what the paleo movement has brought to the table. I don't necessarily agree with everything about it. Like I do wear shoes and I enjoy using a toilet when I go to the bathroom, but you know, I mean, and I know my ancestors didn't brush their teeth in the morning, but I still brush mine. But what it does tell us is that it defies all logic to think that the only food that was available to us for the every year of human existence up until the 1970s would harm us. Like how that's not true. Like we evolved to avoid poisonous substances. We do not evolve to crave things that kill us. Now, this can go off track when biologists, chemists can start to manipulate these levers. But to say that, for example, eating animal products kills you? Why in God's name would we have evolved to be omnivores if that was true? Like it defies all logic. And in fact, again, I have all the respect in the world for vegetarians. I have nothing against it. You can be sane and be a vegetarian. But again, if you are a strict vegetarian and you do not supplement correctly, you will have various deficiencies. So when people come out and say vegetarianism is the optimal diet, well, one, we didn't evolve to be vegetarians. And two, the fact that you have to take supplements and supplements didn't exist up until, you know, 40 years ago kind of indicates that that's not the natural state for humans to be in. So anytime there's a proposition or a suggestion which deviates from the evolutionary template, I think we need to ask, how could that possibly be true? There are cases where it is true, but things like eating foods that contain cholesterol kill you is an example of where it's not at all true and, in fact, is absurd.
You know, I've heard it explained that if we were to take a really big roll of toilet paper and we were to unravel that whole roll of toilet paper and tear one little sheet of toilet paper off of that unraveled roll, that would equate to the amount of time in human existence when we've been eating the foods that we've been eating, the high-carb, refined foods, sugars, the oils, the actual fat oils that we consume in large quantities, trans fats, all those things. That's the difference. The whole rest of the unraveled roll would equate to the rest of human existence where we didn't eat those things. So you're right. I mean, the way the world is set up right now, the fact that all these foods surround us and they're actually the healthy, natural foods are the exception, not the rule. You walk into a supermarket, you do have that one little section for the vegetables and such, one little section for the meat. But the majority of the supermarket is dedicated towards refined, high carb, high sugar, high fat foods. And it just, it's gotten to the point where it almost looks ridiculous to think that we should be eating meat, eggs, fish, vegetables, fruits, and nuts. And I mean, it almost seems ridiculous to some people to suggest such a thing. So, I just thought that was a good example of that kind of just drove the point home.
Absolutely. Well, and Ray, the other thing I think we should keep in mind is, and again, this is a simple point, but we run best on food. I know that's a revelation, but that 99% of your grocery store isn't stocked with food. It's stocked with edible products. And the reason I make that distinction is, for example, food spoils. Like, food was living recently. Like, that it was a plant or an animal, and it generally would need to be refrigerated or frozen. But those are not what we're sold, and that's not what we're consuming. We're not consuming food. We're consuming edible products. And you can imagine, as a food producer, why I'd rather create edible products, right? Now I can create 50 million of these little, cakes that all look the same, all have a shelf life of 100 years. I can ship them all around the world. I don't have to worry about that. I can charge whatever I want for them because no one knows what the hell a sugar smack O-Puff should cost. And I can put health claims on the box, like enriched and fortified. And then I can create little characters to market it. But when you look at spinach, oh, it's so boring and it spoils. There's not even a label on it that tells you spinach is nutritious, but it is, and that's what we should be eating.
Wow. Isn't that the truth? So, all this seems like it's not exactly cutting edge information. We're kind of going backwards, right? It's going from you're going back to the old way of eating. And I think that, as I mentioned, it may sound ridiculous, but it really is the key to achieving lasting fat loss. If your lifestyle does not include large quantities of fruits, vegetables, nuts, meat, and eggs, if that doesn't make up the majority of your diet, there is no diet that's going to help you. There's no science that's going to come to your rescue. You just have to accept that
truth. And again, I know it may – people might say, this sounds basic, but what we're saying in many ways is so obvious that it has to be true, right? We're like, if you want to not get lung cancer, do what you did before you started getting lung cancer, like stop smoking. That's all you need to do. If you want to not get the diseases that are climbing at exponential rates for the past 50 years, do what we did prior to those diseases climbing at exponential rates. That's it. Like, if you don't want to get ran over by a car, don't walk into the street. Like, it's not and it becomes really complicated. Like, if you still choose to, like, run into the street with your eyes closed, it's going to be really hard and complicated not to get hit by cars. But that's what I was sort of saying earlier about the smoking analogy. But if you just say, I'm going to become so full of non-starchy vegetables, lean protein, and whole food natural fats that I'm too full for starches and sweets, it is surprisingly simple, and it has to be, because – keeping yourself healthy and fit is the single most basic ability any organism can have. And we humans are the single most intelligent animal on the planet. So the fact that lions and zebras and dogs and cats can keep themselves slim without trying, we certainly can too.
So, all right, since you're Jonathan Baylor, exterminator of myths, talk a bit about fiber. Because another issue that people run into is they say, well, but what about fiber? Grains are pretty much the best source of fiber. What do you say to that?
So that is just mathematically false. The challenge here is that whole wheat flour is certainly higher in fiber than refined wheat flour. And having one broken leg is also better than having two broken legs. But that doesn't mean that either of those things are desirable. And that's the problem we face today. If the choice is between eating white bread and whole grain bread, you are better off eating whole grain bread. That doesn't mean whole grain bread is good for you. In fact, if you look at like 20 common vegetables versus 20 common whole grain starches, the vegetables will have about 8 times more fiber per calorie than the whole grains will. So again, if we have this assumption that we must eat grains, well then yes, we should eat whole grains. But why are we assuming that we have to eat grains? Back to Ray, your analogy of the toilet paper roll. If we move to an analogy of the entirety of human civilization being one day, we started eating grain late in the evening, like 3 minutes before midnight is when we started eating grain. That doesn't mean eating grain is going to kill you. It just means it's a relatively new addition to the human diet. And you can see why so many people are gluten intolerant, things like that. So if you assume that we do not need to eat grain, which it's true, we do not need to, it's not uniquely nutritional in any way. We simply say, what foods are the highest sources of fiber? And without question, vegetables and fruits are higher in fiber per calorie than whole grains. That's not, it's not even debatable. You can just look at the nutrition label, see how many calories it takes to get 10 grams of fiber, and you will see, bar none, that every single green leafy vegetable and low sugar fruit gives you more fiber per calorie than any whole grain, including quinoa, including all these magical new grains that people are trying to say are healthy for you. No. Vegetables and fruits have more fiber.
Well, you know, how much – I guess that kind of brings us to the fact that a lot of our listeners do in fact eat things like quinoa and do like it and can achieve certain levels of fitness and leanness while eating them. How do we determine how much is too much?
Well, I think it's a personal experiment. I mean, let's be really clear here. There's people that smoke their entire life and don't get lung cancer. That doesn't mean cigarettes don't cause lung cancer. So we all have different tolerance levels for certain foods. If you give someone who has celiac disease a slice of whole wheat bread, you're going to have problems. If you give someone who doesn't have celiac disease a slice of whole wheat bread, you probably won't have problems. So this is something you need to evaluate on a person by person basis. General rule of thumb: if you don't like what you're seeing in terms of your health and fitness, don't keep doing what you're doing. And again, that sounds stupid, but like if you are eating whole grains and you're happy with the results you're getting, I'm not going to sit here and tell you to change that. However, if you're eating whole grains and you do not like the results you're seeing, here's where to start. Eat more vegetables and eat less whole grains. But if what you're doing is working for you, why change? I certainly wouldn't recommend it.
Oh, man. You know, every time I talk to you, I get a little bit smarter. And I love that about you, Jonathan. You always bring some new stuff and new ways of looking at things. So, you know, Jonathan Baylor is the author of the book, The Smarter Science of Slim. And I definitely recommend the book. So if you haven't gone out there and gotten it, be sure to go pick it up. It's available at bookstores everywhere, Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble's. If you like, go to our website, Cut the Fat Podcast. Go to our resources section, and you'll see it under the books that I recommend. And you know, you can click on it and find it directly through there as well. Jonathan, any final parting thoughts before we close up for the night?
Well, I'd say two things, if you don't mind. First, I'm just going to do one quick additional plug, and that's, Ray, as you know, actually, with your help, we started recently a Smarter Science of Slim podcast. So it's excellent. Just load it up on your iPod right next to the Cut the Fat podcast. It's a good companion. So if you would check that out, we'd appreciate it. And also, just if you take nothing else away from this conversation, please take away the following. Up until – like. Put it this way, 90% of us avoided obesity and over 99% of us avoided diabetes before we knew what a calorie was, let alone counted them. That's truth. So next time you think you have to count calories, again, maybe we're in the world where we're smoking and we're like, oh my God, how do I avoid lung cancer? And it's not. Like, it's simple once you have the correct science and once you realize that some of these myths we've been told just aren't true. But we've got to get those myths gone first. So hopefully that's helpful.
Very much so. All right. Well, thank you very much, Jonathan, for joining us again. I'd love to have you on sometime here in the near future. It's always good to have you on to bring in some of the new science and help educate our listeners, man. It's been great.
Always a pleasure, Ray. Thank you so much.
All right. We'll see you next time, Jonathan. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Hey guys, it's Dr. Ray. Once again, I just wanted to thank you for joining us here at Cut the Fat Podcast. Be sure to check us out on the web at www.cutthefatpodcast.com. Tons of great blog posts and articles on there. Also, visit us on Facebook. Search for Cut the Fat Podcast, all one word. Be sure to like the page. Get on there. Leave comments, questions. We love to see those comments, and we love to answer your questions. Also, if you haven't hopped on iTunes and given us a rating, please do so. We read every one of those comments. If you guys have suggestions or recommendations, just email them to us or drop by on Facebook and make them on there as well. All right, so we'll see you guys at the next podcast, where I'll be joined by none other than the Blythe Allberg, and we'll continue on with our discussions about fat loss, health, and wellness. So we'll see you then. Something new. Well, I'm your brother, and I hope you too.